Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 7th of February. We have a few guests with us. I would just like to start. I'll start immediately with our first guest. I would like to thank Charlotte Sector to bring us Christine Stegling, who is the UNAIDS Deputy Executive Director. Welcome, madam, to brief you on the effects of the US funding cuts on the ground and for its organization. Madam, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me to give you a short brief on the impact we're seeing with the pause of U.S. foreign assistance to the AIDS response. It is quite a systemic shock, not just to the AIDS response, as we will hear from others probably, to the development and the multilateral system overall. You all know that we have an emergency humanitarian waiver, which was issued by the U.S. Secretary of State, and we're really grateful for that, ensuring that people living with HIV will remain on treatment. But there is still a lot of confusion about that waiver, and we're hearing and seeing on the ground that it is slowly being implemented. The waiver should mean that 20 million people living with HIV that depend on US aid for their treatment can continue their medication. That's 20 million out of the 30 million people living with HIV in the world. So it's a huge number of people who depend on that support. And let's remember that there's still 10 million people living with HIV in the world that are not on treatment as yet. As I said, there is still a lot of confusion, especially in communities, how the waiver will be implemented, and we're seeing a lot of disruption of delivery of treatment services, especially at the community level. You know, community delivery of medication, of transport services, community health workers, all of these services are currently still impacted, and we are trying to continue monitoring what's happening on the ground. From our perspective as UNAIDS, as the Joint Program on AIDS, we see that the biggest interruption will be on community health systems, which all of you know have been at the center of our success to HIV. So, for example, in Ethiopia, we have 5,000 public health worker contracts that are funded by U.S. assistance, and all of these in all regions of Ethiopia have been terminated, and 10,000 data clerks, very important in Ethiopia, so that we continue monitoring and ensuring that people are on treatment. So as UNAIDS, we estimate that if PEPFAR wasn't reauthorized between 2025 and 2029 and other resources were not found for the HIV response, there would be a 400% increase in AIDS death. That's 6.3 million people, 6.3 million AIDS-related deaths that will occur in future. I was speaking just a couple of nights ago to a colleague from civil society in Uganda, Richard Luzimbo, from the Ugandan Key Populations Consortium. And he was, you know, he was describing what the impact is for communities and really urging me to keep on talking about the fact that foreign aid has been more than financial support in the fight against AIDS, HIV, discrimination, and systemic inequalities. It has been a lifeline for many communities and especially for those most vulnerable and most marginalized communities. You know, a possible cut and a pause has an impact on all of us in the AIDS response. 70% of the global AIDS response are paid for through U.S. Foreign assistance. And we have seen, and it will have an impact on us as an organization, as UNAIDS. 50% of our own funding comes from the U.S. government. We have seen a decline over the years, almost 8% decline between 2020 and 2023 in terms of support. And so, therefore, that's $8 billion short of what we needed, what we need for the AIDS response. So any penny, any cut, any pause will matter for all of us. Let me just just end by saying how important it is that we remember, and we have all seen most recently with COVID, that infectious diseases have a global impact on health and on security. And as we all know, HIV is an infectious disease, one that we are successful in fighting over the last 40 years. So we really urge other member states, national governments to step in, but we also are waiting eagerly to hear what the outcome of the review is of this current pause. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Christine. That was very important to underline. I open the floor to questions in the room. Nina Larson, AFP.
How concerned you are. I mean, even if the funding stays up, that this, you know, what impact that will have, even if the funding does stay up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think what we're seeing is that only as of yesterday, we're starting to get clarity what exactly the waiver will cover. So many community organizations, but also many governments, are not sure what will be covered, and they're therefore pausing. They're overly cautious because they're pausing things that they think they might be asked to repay in the end. And so there's a lot for us to do at country level. And as you know, UNAIDS is in 70 countries. So we're trying to make sure that we're creating that clarity with communities and with governments. There's more likelihood that governments are stepping in, especially in the treatment area. What we're really concerned about and the long-term impact is on prevention of new HIV infections, because we know that many of those services are coming from communities, but also governments will focus right now on keeping people on treatment rather than preventing new infections. I hope that the confusion it's early days, so maybe the next 3-4 days we'll get a bit more clarity at the ground level and can really estimate what the impact is. We're doing at UNAIDS, we're doing a live monitoring with our country offices to see where the bottlenecks are, but also where the long-term impact will be.
Thank you very much. Olivia Le Poitvin, Reuters.
Thank you. Thank you for this briefing. My question to you is, could you just give an estimate in terms of what percentage of groups that you're working with and other services have actually resumed their work following the confusion?
I think it's early. It's too early to tell. We can see that the most affected services are community services, so counseling in communities, education in communities, but also treatment services in communities. We know that a lot of community clinics are exactly for those people who might not go to a government clinic. So what we are really concerned about are treatment interruptions, or for people not to come forward for treatment at all. And as you know, if people are not on treatment, that means we are also having an increase in new HIV infections. Treatment is also prevention. So our biggest concern at the moment is for communities, but also ultimately for governments. Depending on how long the pause will take, governments will step in immediately. We have seen many good examples, Botswana, even in Ethiopia. In many countries, governments have stepped in, for example, in Ethiopia, but they're doing it on a month-by-month basis. So it's a little bit too early to tell what the impact is. I would say that the impact on community groups is a very, very high percentage, because if they were entirely dependent on US government funding.
Thank you very much. I go to the platform. Laurent Sierro, Swiss News Agency.
Yeah, thank you for the briefing. First, if you would be kind to repeat the figure you gave for Ethiopia, because I missed it in the middle of what you said. And then, so you mentioned that 50% funding overall. Has the HQ Geneva taken some precautionary measures in order to anticipate? We could see that with WHO and other agencies. Have something been decided for the HQ in Geneva? Thank you.
Thanks. So what I was referring to Ethiopia, I was saying that we know that 5,000 public health worker contracts are funded by U.S. assistance in all regions of Ethiopia, so they have all been terminated, and 10,000 data clerks were terminated in the last few days. Many governments are trying to bring people, health workers, in from leave, from retirement, to fill the gaps, but these are obviously only temporary measures. In terms of our own situation, obviously all of our agencies that are heavily dependent on US government funds, and as I said in my earlier remarks, the global AIDS response has been heavily dependent on US government funds. 70% of all money for HIV comes from the US government of the global response. Yes, we are making, we have made contingency plans. We are looking at different scenarios, and we are obviously preparing for what the outcome of the review is. And as all agencies, we are hoping that the outcome, that the US government will continue this really important work that they have been done with bipartisan support for over 30 years now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Virginie Pignon, Japan Broadcasting Corporation, NHK.
Yes, hello, thank you. My question, I understand that the waiver has brought a lot of uncertainties, and you are still waiting to clarify this. But is there a possibility that some of the actions or some of the work or the places that have been closed and actions stopped could not be restarted due to this pause? So how do you estimate the impact on the ground of this period of uncertainty not only on the effect of funding? Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very good question, and one that I don't think any of us can respond to with any certainty at the moment. It is a pause. The pause is probably no longer 90 days. By now, it's probably 70 days that we're at, or 75 days. I think we are really gravely concerned that that there will be specific impact, especially on communities, but also on HIV prevention services. And yes, there is a real risk that services will not be will not open again. And I think it's really a moment where we need to come together as the global community to think about, with national governments, how we can fill those gaps. But those gaps are huge in the HIV response.
Paula Dupraz, Geneva Solutions.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask you about the impact of the US decisions regarding US aid in DRC, given that right now, as we speak, there's the special session taking place discussing the situation there in the Human Rights Council.
Paula, thanks for this question. I'll give the floor to Christine, but also for your information, just afterwards we will hear from the WHO representative in DRC. But please, Christina, maybe you have specific on AIDS.
Yeah, I think the WHO representative from DRC is much better placed to answer that question. But just to, have a broader comment on this, what we're seeing is we're having many areas at the moment in the world that are, have conflict, and we know that conflict has real impact on our ability to provide health services. And a subset of that is obviously our ability to offer testing, HIV testing to people, but also to continue treatment, HIV treatment. We are all impacted in that region. We ourselves are also in DRC. And we know that in this really volatile situations, the weakest, the most vulnerable, and what we refer to as key populations will be one of the groups most affected. But I really would rather have their colleagues from DSC answering the question directly.
Thank you very much. I don't see Nina, you have a follow-up.
Sorry, I just wanted to circle back to what you were saying about the impact if the funding was actually fully cut on the 400% figure. I'm just wondering how you calculated that, if you could give a little bit more details on how you reached those figures.
So, yeah, these are models, right, that we're doing, and we have more of those figures, and, you're welcome to have a follow-up conversation. But what we are modeling is treatment interruption. It is modeled on people not initiated newly on treatment. And as you know, we are continuously having problems now with people with advanced AIDS disease that are coming forward for treatment late. And all of these things follow into these models. We are also also our model also tells us that we will have 8.7 million new HIV infections. So these figures go together. But happy to refer you to the people in our office that do the modeling.
Christine, there is another question, sorry, from Isabel Sacco, the Spanish news agency. Isabel.
Yes, thank you very much. It's just if you can share with us some key figures on the funding on the finance that is needed to fight against HIV, because I am seeing that now in the web that at the end of 2023 there $20 billion were available. So what were the expectations for the next year on the needs that you would have, and how this situation will impact on the goal of end with AIDS for 2030? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I think I muddled that up a little bit when I said the figures. So our expectation was $28 billion per year for the AIDS response. And the last year that we have data for it is the one that you're referring to for 2023. So we were $8 billion short globally on the AIDS response. We are obviously enormously worried what that will mean for 2025 and going ahead. I think there are ways that we can try to mitigate some of that impact, and some of that work we have been doing as UNAIDS, working with national governments to see how they can step in and how they can take greater responsibility for their own national responses. But as I said, 70% of the global AIDS response is funded by the US government. You know, countries, the Global Fund, ourselves, communities on the ground through their own treatment programs. This will be, you know, what we're seeing right now. And if we're not seeing new donors or current donors stepping up and stepping in, depending on what the outcome is, it will have a massive impact on the AIDS response.
That's very clear. Thank you, Christine. Sorry. Thank you very much. I think this concludes the questions from our journalists. Thank you so much for this update. It's very important. And as you know, Charlotte is also available if you want to follow up with more data and speaking to more experts.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's indeed stay on DRC. And I would like to welcome Christiane, who has brought us Dr. Burahima Hama Sambo, who, as I said, is the WHO representative for the DRC and is reaching us from Kinshasa. Before giving the doctor the floor, I would just like to underline, of course, as it has been said, that this morning the Human Rights Council is meeting on the situation of the human rights in the east of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. While we are speaking, the participants are hearing from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, from Bintou Keita, the Special Representative of the Secretary General in the DRC and Chief of MONUSCO, and Surya Deva, the Chair of the Coordination Committee of the Special Procedures. This, and then they will hear about the interventions from the member states and the NGOs. As you may have seen from the information which Pascal distributed to you, there will be the consideration of a draft resolution for adoption this afternoon. And of course, you can count on Pascal and his team to send you the appropriate information. But I would also like to underline that yesterday, the Secretary General made a special appeal for peace in DRC ahead of a summit today with the leaders from the East African Community and the Southern African Development Community, which is taking place in Tanzania. The Secretary General added that next week in Addis Ababa, he will take part in a summit-level meeting of the African Union Peace and Security Council, where the crisis will be front left and right and left and front and center. Sorry, he said his message is clear: silence the guns, stop the escalation, respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of DRC, uphold international human rights law and international humanitarian law. And of course, you have seen the full transcript we have sent it to you. And with that, I would really like now to go to Dr. Hama Sambo and to hear about the alarming health crisis in this region of the DRC. Doctor.
Thank you, and good morning to all. And thank you also for the opportunity given to WHO to describe and talk about the dear health and the humanitarian crisis in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. Just to say, the recent surge in violence in the DRC has led to significant loss of life, trauma, displacement, and destruction of critical health infrastructure, exacerbating an already dire situation of millions of people. The situation remains tense and volatile, and the health needs are immense. But WHO remains on the ground and is providing life-saving intervention and medical supplies, supporting health workers to deliver, and coordinating the emergency response in all aspects that come to the health. Just to say, when it comes to injuries and death, the hospitals and more are overwhelmed and in and around the Goma region. In North Kivu, this is in Goma, more than 3,082 injured and 843 dead have been reported from 31 health facilities. In South Kivu, where the fighting was actually spilled over the last few days, we have so far recorded more than 65 injuries from only three hospitals in the South Kivu. The impact on healthcare is really huge. The attack on health are a violation of international law, as you all know. And we have counted about 70 health facilities in North Kivu that have been damaged or completely destroyed. We have also seen that ambulances that have been attacked and some destroyed, and WHO supported health clinic in North Kivu was temporarily occupied by the armed group. Health workers were not spared, and some have fled for them to save their life, and others who remain are completely overwhelmed with the number of wounded and what we are taking care of. We have infected with the risk of multiplied. As you know, South Kivu or North Kivu was already endemic for cholera. And for the first 25 days of January alone, from beginning from 1st to 27 January, more than 600 suspected cases of cholera had been recorded with 14 deaths. And we know also in 2024, in North and South Kivu, close to 22,000 cases of cholera were identified with 60 deaths due to cholera. Before the fighting erupted, you know, we are responding to monkeypox, to mpox. Before the escalation, there were 143 patients in isolation, in isolation unit in North Kivu. 1 week later, 95% of them have fled health for, have fled, and health workers have been able to bring back some of them. Vaccination was partially restored or resumed just 3 days ago in Goma, and we have been able to vaccinate about 276 contacts of about contact of 101,000 have been the contact of contact. Malaria continues to be a major killer. Measles is also close to be an endemic in the North Kivu. In 2024, more than 11,000 cases and 115 deaths due to measles were reported. The province also has many cases of meningitis and tuberculosis. When it comes to the continuity of care, this is in question. This has to do with chronic disease, both chronic disease from infectious origin and chronic disease of non-infectious origin. So chronic disease of non-infectious origin, such as cancer, diabetes, hypertension, mental health, and complications during pregnancy and childhood, all have been seen, have been impacted. Malnutrition is also a health concern. Before the crisis, over 1 out of 4 people in the region were facing an acute food insecurity, IPC 3 and above. When it comes to the lab issues, the North Kivu hosts one of the two major labs of the country, called the INRB. This is a lab where we have high pathogens, and those working in the lab have been able to continue their analysis, and the lab is still working. WHO is present through its hub in Goma and Bukavu, and the WHO is coordinating the health and humanitarian response, assessing health sector capacity and identifying gaps. And just to mention that before the airport was closed in Goma, WHO was able to fly in a cargo with 23 metric tons of medicine and life-saving IPC supplies and 25 tents to increase hospital capacity to about 1,000 beds. And the life-saving medicine and supply we were able to bring in is about to treat about 20,000 injured people and more than 10,000 cholera patients. The emergency health supplies like IV fluids, anesthetics, antibiotics, and so more for more than 300,000 people have been able to be flying in just before the airport was shut down. Supplies for IPC, such as hand washing, waste management supplies, have also been flying, but now are actually getting to a very minimum level of the supplies. What WHO needs, and so even what we have been able to deliver, WHO have been supplying to almost all the humanitarian and those on the ground life-saving medicine. So WHO needs additional resources to bring to be able to save more lives, and we have estimated an urgent need for about $50 million. WHO is calling for a humanitarian access for the protection of health workers and facilities, and an end to attack on healthcare facilities. Health facilities, supplies, workers, and patients should be protected. Ultimately, we call for peace and an end of the unimaginable and long suffering of the people in this region. And I thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for this comprehensive update. I'll open the floor to questions now. I see online Yuri Aprilev, RIA Novosti.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everybody. My question is relating to the laboratory that is in Goma. We had the past week ICRC saying that they are a little bit scared that some viruses, and especially Ebola, can go out from this laboratory because the parties were fighting not far and because of the cut of the electricity. Do you have any idea how is the situation with this laboratory now? Is there a scared also in WHO that the viruses can go outside this laboratory? Do you have any information on that? Thank you.
Dr. Amasambo?
Thank you. Yes, we have the lab we have visited ourselves just the Friday before the fighting erupted. This lab has actually what you call level 2 and level 3 capacity, meaning that yes, it has high pathogens such as Ebola, Marburg, Mpox, and COVID-19 viruses. The biobank of this lab is very well kept. And WHO was able to supply fuel for the generator to keep running even when electricity was cut off in Goma. So I can say the lab is safe because the lab also can be remotely locked. And this is what has been done until we understood that electricity, water, and everything is back. And now I told you the lab is functioning normally and there's no threat coming out of this lab for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nina Larson, AFP.
Sorry, yeah, just to follow up on that. So in terms of the fighting that's been happening nearby the lab, you're sure that it's secured and it won't be breached? And I also have a question on another subject.
Dr. Amasam.
Yes, thank you. Yes, as I said, there is a private company, Garingo Lab, and they were there, and we have been able to visit them and even make sure that not only they are on site and bring them what they need, as since when there was a limited movement, and we worked very much with the ICRC. We brought, as I said, fuel for the generator to continue running, and we were able to bring those who were boarding food and water, so to make sure that nothing has been attempted from the lab. So I can assure you the lab is safe. And as I said, this lab is remotely locked because it's a lab that is actually working Institut Mérieux of France. And they know very well that even from France, there where they are, the lab can be automatically locked. So really the lab is safe. And I can assure you there's no concern for now that any pathogen can leak out.
Thank you. Nina, the other question was not for Dr. Sam. Okay, we'll take it afterwards then. Okay, Paula Dupras, Geneva Solution. Paula?
Yeah, I'd like to return to the question that I had earlier regarding the funding suspensions from USAID and how that may be potentially affecting emergency response in the region.
Dr. Sam, I don't know if it's for you or maybe Christian want to say something, but please, please go ahead.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I can attempt to respond, and certainly if Christian wants to. It's just to say United States' recent decision to freeze foreign aid is a significantly impacting the relief effort in the Democratic Republic of the country. Just to mention that last year, U.S. contributed to as much as close to 70% of countries' humanitarian response. Additionally, the U.S. is a major funder of MPOX response that our Director General has declared public health concern of public health emergency of international concern, and has pledged, U.S. has pledged about 1 million vaccine doses of its own stock to the global effort. So while WHO humanitarian response in the region relied on funding from other donors, including the European Union, the United Kingdom, and WHO Contingency Fund for Emergency, reduction in overall aids will have repercussions for people's health in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the briefing before me, I know many questions were asked about HIV. I mentioned the HIV. These are chronic diseases of infectious origin. Both chronic HIV and tuberculosis have been also been a concern because of the suspension of the US funding.
Doctor, sorry, you said 17 or 70%? 70.
70% for the country's humanitarian.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know if Christian want to add anything to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just one or two things. So on the one, together with the HIV teams and the UNAIDS colleagues, we are reviewing this, and it's likely to have likely severely impacted, of course. On the other hand, we do welcome the recent PEPFAR announcement, so that's certainly good news. But the most important thing is that we will make every effort to maintain the response to infectious diseases, whatever necessary. That's our main priority on the ground. Second note, there was a press release sent just before the press briefing this morning on DRC, and we will also share the speaking notes of Dr. Weber.
Would be welcome, I'm sure. Christian, since you are on, Nina had a question for you. Sorry, because I think we don't have other questions on DRC, so let me go to Nina.
Yeah.
Thanks. Hi, Christian. I had, it's also regarding U.S. funding, but also the CDC. I'm wondering, yesterday, apparently, the CDC put up a notice on its website briefly about concern around cats spreading H5N1 to humans and then removed it. And I'm wondering if that's something that you've been informed about, and also what the communication is like now and the concerns around the spread of H5N1 in light of the possible lack of communication from the U.S. on this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nina. The only thing I do have is that we were recently informed by the IHR focal point on the so-called swine flu H1N2 cases in the U.S. I have no further info on the H5 at this point.
Thank you. Okay, so I don't see other questions for WHO. I would like to thank very much Dr. Burema Habasambo, calling in from Kinshasa, and wish him good luck with his work. And thanks, Christian, for being with us. James, would you like to come to the podium? While we are waiting for James, I would just like to read you a message that I received from Juliet Tuma and from UN UNRWA Commissioner General, and that's on behalf of UNRWA. And it's, of course, on Gaza. The rights of the Palestinians continue to be violated, say the message. Since the war began, people in Gaza have undergone systematic dehumanization. Palestinians do matter, including those in Gaza. Their rights, lives, and futures matter. Human rights cannot be applied selectively. As the UN Secretary General said, peace requires ending the occupation and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Gaza as an integral part, a viable and sovereign Palestinian state side by side with Israel. At UNRWA, our teams are committed to continue providing critical assistance to Palestinian refugees who need us most until empowered Palestinian institutions become a lasting and viable alternative. End of the statement. You also have this on the X account of UNRWA Commissioner General, and we can distribute it to you later on. Juliet is not with us today, but she's available to answer your questions if you have any. Just contact her directly. And that brings me to welcome James. James, you are back from Haiti. We've seen you there. And just maybe give us an update on the situation of the children there. Thank you.
Thanks, Alessandra. Yeah. A staggering 1,000% increase in sexual violence against children in Haiti has turned their bodies into battlegrounds. So the tenfold rise between 2023 and last year comes as armed groups inflict unimaginable horrors on children. Now, remembering, of course, that these are verified, reported incidents, so the real number is likely to be much worse. Almost equally staggering is how little coverage this gruesome statistic has received. And so perhaps then if numbers have lost meaning, the children behind the horror will count. Rosalyn is a girl I met, not her real name. Rosalyn is 16. Late last year, she left her friend's house to go to the shop and was abducted by armed men. She was placed in a van with a number of other young girls and taken to a warehouse. There, she was extensively beaten. She was drugged and, over what she believes to be the course of a month, relentlessly raped. When the armed group realised that Rosalyn didn't have anyone to pay the kidnapping ransom, she was released. She's currently in a UNICEF-supported safe house with more than a dozen other young girls, all receiving care. Now, of course, this is a press briefing and we know that numbers do matter, so let me share a few more from Haiti. Armed groups now control 85% of Port-au-Prince. Let me repeat that. 85% of the capital of Haiti is controlled by armed groups. It's an astounding case of insecurity for a capital city. Last year alone, child recruitment surged by 70%. So right now, up to half of all armed group members are children, some as young as 8 years old. Many are taken by force, others are manipulated, many are driven by extreme poverty. It's a lethal cycle. Children are recruited into the groups that then fuel their own suffering. And in Haiti, that suffering is immense. 1.2 million children live under the constant threat of armed violence. Essential services have collapsed in Haiti. Hospitals are overwhelmed. More than half of the healthcare facilities lack the equipment and the medication to treat children in emergencies. Playgrounds, schools, and homes have been turned into battlegrounds, forcing thousands and thousands of families to flee. More than 500,000 children have been displaced. An estimated 3 million of this tiny island require humanitarian assistance this year. Education, more than 1.5 million children and teachers are affected by school closures. And as we noted at the start, sexual violence is rampant. Now, the abhorrence of an attack on a child is obvious. A tenfold increase is ruinous. The pain, of course, doesn't stop with the survivor. It ripples through families, it shatters communities, and it scars a society as a whole. And yet, Haitians refuse to give up. Take just one example. UNICEF has 135,000 U reporters. Now, these people embody the commitment of Haitians, everyday Haitians, bringing energy, dedication, and help to those who need it most. U-Report's a digital platform created by UNICEF. It engages communities, particularly youth, in social issues. So in Haiti, in 1 month last year alone, these U-Reporters, their efforts led to the identification and referral of cases of malnutrition, under-vaccination, and essential support to pregnant women. Haiti's progress starts with children. Now, with incredible partners UNICEF has, and I give you a few things, there are many more, we've created 32 mobile safe spaces to prevent and respond to gender-based violence, deployed more than 380 healthcare professionals across more than 105 institutions, distributed cash to 30,000 families, and treated more than 80,000 children for moderate and severe wasting. Programs that meet children's needs can disrupt the cycles of violence and reduce children becoming victims or children becoming perpetrators. And yet, UNICEF's funding appeal for Haiti last year, 2024, was $221 million. 72% of that is unfunded. That, of course, starkly contrasts with the urgent need for education, for protection and development opportunities to prevent children being drawn into violence. Without these, violence is going to continue to consume this generation and future generations. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for spotting light on this crisis. James, I open the floor to questions. I've got Yuri Aprilev on the platform.
Yes, thank you, Alexandra. Thank you, James. But it was for WHO. So I don't know if the left already or... Yeah.
Christian is still on the platform, so just wait. Maybe afterwards, after Haiti, we can give him the floor and you can ask your question. Any question on Haiti? I don't see any hand up. But that doesn't mean that it's not important. Thank you very much for briefing us on this incredibly dire situation, James. And we'll include, of course, the notes in the summary. So let's go to you, Yuri, and Christian. Maybe you can answer the question from Yuri. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Christian. It is more a request than a question, but just asking when we will have the next briefing, even if it's online with Dr. Tedros for journalists, because it has been a long time that we didn't have anyone and we have a lot of questions, as you can imagine, for Dr. Tedros. So just wondering if you have a plan to do that or when. Thanks.
I believe so.
Good question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So good question, and we're also waiting for it. Now there's the ongoing EB, and during the EB and before, during the PBAC, he never does it. So during the ongoing governance meeting, but we're expecting one soon after the EB. Count on next week, but it needs to be confirmed.
So if there are no other questions for any of our colleagues, don't see any hand up, so let me just read you my last announcement about the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which is reviewing today the report of Luxembourg. The next country to come up are the Congo, Sri Lanka, and Liechtenstein. The Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights will open next Monday, Monday morning at 10 a.m., its 77th session. Countries to be reviewed under this session are Croatia, Peru, United Kingdom, Rwanda, Philippines, and Kenya. So we will keep you informed about the various countries when they come up. This is what I have on my list. If there are no other questions from anybody, and I don't see any, so I hope you'll continue to follow the Human Rights Council special session on DRC. And thank you very much. I wish you a very good weekend, and I'll see you next week. Thank you.